Hey guys, Mike with Flight Bridge Ed. I've been an EMS training officer since 2008, and I don't know how many times I've had to deliver the bad news to someone about an expired certification. That means no work. That's where Piace comes in to save the day. Never be caught off guard again with an expired cert. Go to the App Store for your device and search for Piace, P-I-A-C-E-T, the one-stop application to manage and share all of your certifications. You know you don't want to be that guy or gal, and don't rely on your agency to tell you about your certifications. Go to Piace to manage your own certs and have some peace of mind. Download Piace today.
What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top. Located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
Mikey V.
You started the last one off like that. You better come up with something. You better come up with something better.
All right. Howdy, y'all. This is Dr. Jeff Jarvis, and Mikey V is back a second week in a row.
What's going on, party people? How's it going, Dr. Jarvis?
Man, it is going great. It is so good to see you. You know, it looks like it was just mere minutes ago that I spoke to you last.
It was, but one thing I'm going to call you out on, and I hope you leave this in. At least I changed shirts. You did not.
I'm not sure you did change shirts.
Oh, I did, buddy.
Did you?
Oh, yes.
Maybe I should have. I just like this shirt so much.
It's nice.
That,
it's
nice. You know, I just wear it all the time.
Yeah.
And maybe I don't wash it as much as I should.
Yeah, no, that's totally fine. But I just wanted to throw that out there. I thought it was good.
We might have been recording multiple things at the same time.
Maybe. We got to work smarter, not harder, right?
That's right. Well, do you know what this shirt is?
Well, I can clearly see that it's ATP, but it doesn't probably mean what I think it means.
What do you think it means?
Well, it's not adenosine triphosphate, clearly.
Okay, not that.
But maybe it is. I don't know.
It is the Accidental Tech Podcast. It's a nerdy Apple-based podcast that I listen to. And they got.
And we have their shirt.
I like their shirt. And so does this look a little bit like an old M1 BMW?
A little bit, but it also has the sort of original Mac colors too.
Apple colors. Yep. That is it. The six Apple colors.
Yep, exactly.
I love this shirt.
I often wonder and think to myself, would the people want more EMS Lighthouse Project options for t-shirts? I think they would.
I think they would.
Would they like Texas as a delegated practice t-shirt? I think they would.
I think, you know, it could have the outline of Texas, Texas's delegated practice on the front, and on the back, it could have a waterfall plot.
I think that would be awesome. But we got to throw a little nod to Lighthouse, though, on there somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. It would definitely be on there.
Somehow, some way. But we'll make that happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Mikey, you know, we have to discuss, I think it's a rule in our charter. It says, thou shalt discuss what thou art drinking.
It's exactly like that. It's in the red words, too.
Red words. So
yeah.
What are you drinking?
You're going to be very disappointed. I'm drinking Oregon's finest water.
Outstanding. Today.
Well, you know, we mentioned this in our last episode, but it was hotter than the devil's crotch here for a while. So you got to hydrate or die.
I get it. I understand. Well, in nice balmy Texas, I mean, it was only 92 degrees here.
That's about what we got going right now.
And that's actually really good for us around July 4th. I am drinking a local beer. So this is from, you're going to love the name of this brewery. This is the Barking Armadillo Brewery. They are right down the street from me in Georgetown, Texas. This is the Eurotrip Pilsner. I wanted something light with a reasonably low ABV. And it's nice, nice little Pilsner beer.
Well, and here's a little sneak preview for all the watchers and listeners out there. We will be broadcasting a podcast from the tale of the aardvark or whatever you just called.
Barking armadillo. It's a Texas thing, man.
Okay. Well, we're going to be there in October. And so we will be recording at least one episode, maybe more. I don't know. We'll see. Live together in real life. And that's going to be awesome. So I'm very much looking forward to that.
I am too. I mean, you and Ritu, you got the McMenamins thing. Oh, you've been kind of cheating on the McMenamins now.
Well, we did for one, but I think we're actually recording this Thursday, which doesn't mean anything because I don't know when this is going to come out. But anyway, about 5 days from now, and I think we're going back to our old haunt, the old church, McMenamins in Wilsonville, Oregon. So that'll be good.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Outstanding. Well, it's good stuff. I'm glad that your heat wave is over. I'm glad that the power grid in Oregon seems to be a little more resilient than the power grid in Texas. If
not that many people lost power, so that was good.
That is outstanding.
Yeah.
So you know what else is really cool, Mikey?
If I was a wagering, well, I thought you were like going to ask me and I had to answer, so I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, let's do that. What is really cool, Mikey?
Airway papers.
Airway papers are always cool. Of course, airway papers. But I was going to talk about something else.
Okay, copy.
What I was going to say is, if my calculations are correct, this is episode 47 of the EMS Lighthouse Project.
Can you believe that? I remember it was like just yesterday when we started this thing.
It is. So we started off a little bit of interestingly, an airway podcast. You know, kind of bringing it all back home.
Yeah, it's what we do.
Well, I'll tell you what, I got three papers, not one, not two, but three papers, all from the Near Airway Registry. I think we should do some stuff from Near. What do you think?
I think we should. For those of you that maybe don't know, that is the National Emergency Airway Registry.
Absolutely. You know, the thing that I'm a little bit jealous about is they are cranking outstanding paper after pretty decent paper out of this registry. And it's all emergency department airway stuff. I'm an EMS airway guy, and I want EMS airway registries. I want one.
What gives? How come we don't have that?
We just don't. I guess there's no money in it, but I'm thinking that I got my ponder cap on. You know, I took my Astros hat off and I got my ponder cap on. And I've been pondering ways to get ourselves an EMS registry. So we'll keep at it. Maybe more news to come.
So let me ask you this. So let's talk about data and data sources and all that stuff for a second. So how does the data get into the NEAR?
You bet. Well, it's probably a good, so first off, this is an international registry. And by that, it probably means there are one or two sites in Canada.
Perfect.
25 emergency departments. Most of them are academic. There are a few community hospitals in there. And in order to submit your data to NEAR, you have to agree to have a site coordinator to do quality improvement on your, or quality assurance really, on your data, and assure that you are getting at least 90% of all intubations done in your emergency department or entered into the registry. And they have a variety of ways of assuring that. So basically what happens is when a doc does the intubation, after they've done it, they sit down at a computer, clickety click, click, they pull up a secure website and they enter in basically a web database. And it's
so there's no data. There's no data being extracted out of Epic or some other thing.
As far as I know, there's not. Now, my version of my vision, I should say, for an EMS airway registry is that we would be able to extract data from the EPCR. For example, we are working on building one internally on our, we got a SQL server that we stand up. We export out all of our ESO data into that SQL data set that's running on our servers. And then we create add-on databases. So we have an add-on airway registry right now that's just a QA form on there. We have the same thing for cardiac arrest. And ultimately, what I would like to be able to do is import all of the data that we actually, you don't even need to import it because it's already there. You already have age and weight and a lot of those difficult airway characteristics. We would still need the medic to fill out some information.
Yeah.
What was their view and, you know, which some stuff. And then we would have, in my case, it would be John Gonzalez, who does our analysis of all the biometric files. He would go in and, you know, measure the duration of the intubation and what the peri-intubation sats are. Basically, all the stuff that he's doing already, he's been doing since our DSI paper, put that into the registry. And I think we'll have some pretty rich data. If we can get it working in our shop, maybe we can expand it out and get it working in other shops also and get a more rich data set.
Yeah. Well, it's good. We should, it's definitely a noble cause, obviously.
I think we need some good data and not just from great, big, really, really large EMS systems that we see in PART or, you know, the big airway trials. Because I'm kind of partial on this. I think maybe the bigger systems are fundamentally different than the mid-sized systems. So I'd like to find out.
Well, let's figure out what we can do and let's make it happen.
Let's do it. Let's dive in, shall we?
Let's do it.
Paper number one, Dr. April and his colleagues. This is peri-intubation cardiac arrest in the emergency department, a NEAR study. This was published this year in Resuscitation. So we talked about what the NEAR registry is. All three of these papers are going to be from the NEAR registry. They looked at patients greater than 14 years old who underwent intubation in the emergency department. This first paper, they did it between 2016 and 2018. They exclude from the registry pre-intubation cardiac arrest. In other words, people who are intubated because of cardiac arrest.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that is a little bit different than people who arrest around the time of the intubation.
Agreed. Yep, absolutely. So they
exclude pre-intubation arrest. For at least this trial, they're looking at only the first intubation attempt because you get some confounding issues there if you're looking at multiple attempts. So they're only looking at the first pass, and then they're also excluding any patients with missing data or who had a surgical crike. And basically what they did was they separated all of these patients into whether they had a peri-intubation cardiac arrest or not. And they defined that as within 15 minutes of the intubation.
Okay.
So now you got, you took your big registry and broke it up into two groups, those who coded around intubation and those who did not. And then they said, what characteristics are there that are different between these two groups? Is there anything that we can really take away about the patients who have a peri-intubation arrest? Well, it turns out there are. And the bottom line on this, peri-intubation shock, so hypotension, highly associated with peri-intubation cardiac arrest. They have an adjusted odds ratio after adjusting for all of the things that we might think would lead us to code, 6.2. So 520% higher odds of peri-intubation cardiac arrest if you intubate patients in shock. That is definitely statistically significant. They also found, and this is near and dear to my heart because of the work I've done on this, peri-intubation or pre-intubation, I should say, hypoxia. So if you intubate the patient when they are hypoxic, that is an adjusted odds ratio of 3.1, also significant. So a 210% increased odds in the likelihood of peri-intubation cardiac arrest if you tube them when they're hypoxic. And then the last thing they found was that the person doing the intubation deemed it a crash airway. Hmm. Now, what they mean, and crash is my term, what they mean by crash is that they did not have time to adequately prepare the patient. That had an adjusted odds ratio of 1.8, so an 80% increase in the likelihood of peri-intubation arrest. So my take on that crash term, I don't know whether they couldn't take the time to do it or whether
or they just didn't. Yeah.
Looking at EMS data, certainly looking at my own system, we just didn't. Once we stressed the importance of it and started taking the time, turns out things got better.
Yeah, I think it seems to be quite the juxtaposition. How do you like that term?
That is a strong
because,
word.
Yeah, I mean, that's a $3 word we're breaking out here. But, you know, I don't think there's anything new that we didn't know in this paper, right? So, number one, I don't mean that as a negative. I mean, how many more times do we need to see that we cannot be intubating hypoxic and hypotensive patients because it's going to kill them, right? So that's what I mean by that. And say it louder for the people in the back, right? I mean,
preach, brother.
And what I think the juxtaposition is the mentality is that if we rush in to manage the airway and take care of hypoxia by intubating them, that's going to make them better. And that just doesn't jive, right? Even though that seems to jive, it is not what our patients need, right? There needs to be the physiological management of these people. We need to improve them hemodynamically. We need to get them ready to be intubated. And like, I mean, I tell the story all the time, and I'm not going to tell it now, but just the small pieces, if I could just go back in time to this one call that I remember, I mean, the guy was bad. He probably would have died anyway, but I certainly did not do him any favors by intubating him in the time frame that I did, right? And so knowing what I know now, if I could go back and tell myself, help him first, then intubate him, I don't know, would it have made a difference? I feel like knowing what I know, it probably would have.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I think all of us, you know, maybe there's a podcast out there about that one call, but
or that one day,
talking about that one call. Yeah, we all have an example of that call. If we've been doing this for a while,
yeah,
really, we really do know this. And you're right. They're not breaking new ground here. As a matter of fact, in the paper, they said, we're not breaking new ground. This is confirmatory.
100%.
It just strengthens our level of evidence on this. And as a matter of fact, to tie this back into our episode 46, going over the LLSA articles, we looked at another paper from the EPIC trial that showed not only is hypoxia and hypotension associated with cardiac arrest, it's associated with permanent cardiac arrest.
So you're not getting them back.
Yeah. If you look at this, going into cardiac arrest, the mortality of that was 33%. So it's not they just lost pulses for a second. I got the tube in. They came back. 33% of those people stayed dead. The mortality, if you didn't arrest, 4%. Huge, huge difference.
Yeah.
So yeah, it really does make a difference. Now, just the specifics on this paper, this was an observational paper, so maybe there are some unmeasured confounders that are possible, absolutely. They did look at some other things. The indication for intubation didn't make a difference. The induction agent, whether it was etomidate or ketamine, more on that in a second.
Indeed.
That didn't make a difference. There's no difference in first pass success. So first pass success in those who did not arrest was 88.4%. It was 87.9% in those who did. No statistical difference. So yeah, really the bottom line on this thing is peri-intubation, hypoxia, and hypotension are bad. As you said, how many frickin' times do we have to say this? We need to get this through our heads.
Yeah.
Take the time, resuscitate before you intubate, as Dr. Weingart keeps saying. Systolic blood pressure under 100, bad. SpO2 under 91, bad. Do something about it and then intubate the patient.
Yep. Yep. Exactly. All right. So this next paper I'm super interested in because it's very timely as my system is going to be starting to make the transition to rock. So we talked a little bit about the last paper, a little bit about the induction, right? So ketamine, etomidate, whatever it was. We still have a little bit more on that. But I'm curious about the paralytic. So I know this next paper was looking at rock dosing. And again, I'm very interested and want to be all ears on this because this is going to be us.
I hear you're switching. You have been using Sux, I take it?
Yep, we've been using Sux, and we've had a couple of there's probably nothing unusual about some of the things that we've seen with Sux, right? It's the only paralytic we carry. So we've had a couple instances. And when I say we, I mean talking to greater we in our system.
Right.
There's been a couple instances where we've had a gravely ill person at a dialysis clinic. They got ketamine. We got a potassium problem. And, you know, when you just don't have another choice, I mean, we all know that there's a lot of patients that probably shouldn't get Sux. But when it's what you got, it's what you do. And you just sort of go with it, right? And so we're just adding in rock as an option for us, which I really love. But there has been a lot of talk, especially in some of these what we would consider sicker patients. What should we do with the dosing? Do you increase it? Do you decrease your sedative? Do you increase the paralytic? So I'm really curious to discuss this paper a little bit and hear what you had to say about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So there is a lot of discussion, exactly as you said, about adjusting the drugs you use in RSI based on the patient condition.
Yeah.
Now, we don't do that in my system. I've been waiting for, you know, maybe some additional evidence. Maybe there's literature out there and I just haven't seen it. So it actually turns out it's really timely because as I was reading this paper, I might have gotten a little distracted and opened up the Twitter bot and taken a look at it. Now, I had a DM from a paramedic in Colorado, Matt King, and Matt was asking me about this. Hey, do you adjust the dose of your rock uronium based on the patient's blood pressure? And I said, no, we don't. However, stay tuned because there's a pod coming out on this exact question. So great, great concept. The title of this paper, this is from Dr. Levin. It's also has a co-author on this was Michael April, who was the lead author on the last paper. Basically, it's the same group. It's the
Sure.
new group.
Yeah.
The title of the paper is The Association of Rock Uronium Dosing and First Attempt Intubation Success in Adult Emergency Department Papers, or Patients. Sorry. This was published in the Canadian Journal of Emergency Medicine this year. So we're going to go international, bring in our Canuck friends.
I love it.
Speaking of Canuck friends, I have to tell you, complete and total diversion. I was surfing the tubes of you looking for help in how to set something up. And I came across an interview where Dan Rather, looking rather old,
was
interviewing Geddy Lee. I have been a Rush fan my entire life. This was like a 20-minute interview. It was before the rather unfortunate recent events where Neil died. But they were interviewing him and talking about the band. And anyway, as a Rush fan, it was really cool. So if you're a fellow Rush fan, go check out that interview. It was wonderful.
Maybe we'll link it in the description down below on YouTube.
Well, you just kind of got me on the hook then. I guess I got to do it now.
Yes, you do.
All right. So back to the paper, away from my little side trip down Squirrel. Memory lane with Rush.
Yeah.
We are the priest of the temples of Syrinx. All the gifts of life.
Yes.
So this was another near paper. Same concept, 25 emergency departments, same kind of thing, greater than 14 years old who undergo intubation. Now, they limited this to just those who got rock uronium, and they also excluded the other stuff, the missing data, or if there was no dosing information about rock given. And their fundamental question was they wanted to use first pass success as an outcome, and they wanted to see how the dose of rock uronium affected the outcome. And they broke it up into several groups. they had under 1 milligram, 1 milligram, and this is milligram per kilogram, by the way, less than 1 to 1.1, 1.1 to 1.2, 1.2 to 1.3, and then greater than or equal to 1.4. So if you look up the dose, for most, a lot of the papers, it's looking around 0.6 milligrams per kilogram in the anesthesia literature. And this is for very well prepared patients. They're fasted, you know, just pristine conditions, and they're otherwise healthy. That's not who we intubate. That's not our time.
Yeah.
So if you look at the typical description, most emergency department literature talks about 1 milligram per kilogram. And I think that's what a lot of people do. Maybe bump it up to 1.2 milligrams.
Yeah, that's what ours is, 1.2.
1.2. We went with 1.0 because the math is easier. And, you know, it's, I said, what could possibly be the functional difference between 1 and 1.2 milligrams per kilogram? Let's find out.
Yeah.
That's what they did. They also, by the way, took a look and they did a subgroup analysis based on device type. Was it direct versus video? And whether the patient was hypotensive. And that's really where this comes in. I think for our, my assumption going into this paper was for those patients who were not hypotensive, the dose probably isn't that important. That was my thought. All right. So what do we know? So if you look at first pass success, this is their primary outcome. The overall first pass success was 89.7%. So that's about 12 to 13% higher than most studies of EMS intubation.
Yeah, agree.
So doing better. Now, I will tell you that these are the academic centers with emergency medicine residency programs who are interested in airway research. So I don't know how representative this is of the rest of emergency medicine or EMS.
Okay, fair enough.
But I think the conclusions they make about ROCK dosing is very relevant. So overall, 89.7, 90%. And what we see as we increase the dose is an increase in first pass success.
Pretty
steady increase.
Yeah.
They also looked at peri-intubation desaturation, and that decreased as the dose increased. So overall, it was around 8% peri-intubation hypoxia, which, as an aside, is way lower than the rest of the literature supports.
Wow.
The rest of the literature says the rate is anywhere from about 25 to 50%. So this is way lower. And again, I believe this is an indication that these departments who are participating in NEAR are probably more focused on airway. It's a lot like the departments that are participating in the CARES registry are probably more focused on cardiac arrest outcomes.
Sure.
So the bottom line, inverse relationship between DSAT, the higher the dose, the less the DSAT. Now, they also looked at first pass success for those patients who were hypotensive. And they saw exactly the same pattern. Overall rate, basically 89.8%, 90% first pass, 94.9% in the highest dose range. So with hypotensive patients, it was even more apparent that there's a dose response relationship. Now they looked at it as a function of device type.
Yeah. Super curious about this one.
So direct laryngoscopy, they found exactly the same thing, higher first pass success rates with higher doses. Video laryngoscopy, no difference, not a statistical difference. The 1 to 1.1 milligram per kilogram had a 92.3% first pass success. Greater than 1.4, 92.4. Same numbers, no difference with VL. Now, overall, by the way, I also, you know, I'm a VL kind of guy.
Yeah. That's a bit of a head scratcher.
I can't pass up an opportunity to point out that the overall first pass success, 87.6 with DL, 91.6 with VL.
Yeah.
All right. So the, what do we, and there are actually some interesting slides, and I think we might put some of these slides into the pod. The first is a nice forest plot. I mean, you can't have a lighthouse project.
Who doesn't love a good forest plot or a waterfall or something? I mean, geez. Yeah.
Waterfalls are even nicer.
Hey, I think so.
Did you know Texas is a delegated practice state?
I did know that. Weird.
Drink up, Joseph.
Drink up.
So what this forest plot is looking at is they have a little dotted line right down the middle. That is an odds ratio of one, which means there's no difference between the two groups. If you look at the, and you get a little red, or I'm sorry, a green forest plot, that is the greater than 1.4 milligram per kilogram. Red is the 1.2 to 1.3, and then whatever that color is, I think it's blue.
It's a blue circle.
Less than one up to 1.1. And if your systolic blood pressure is greater than 100, there's no difference in any of them. So my pretest probability, if you will, my gestalt before we read this, turns out it's probably true. If they're not hypotensive,
probably doesn't matter.
If they are hypotensive, there's a clear difference. That green line is way over the null line. And remember, that line is the 95% confidence interval. And if your 95% confidence interval crosses the dotted line of one, that means there's no significant difference.
Yeah.
If you look at the 1.2 to 1.3 or less than 1 to 1.1.
Crosses the line.
Yep, absolutely. So higher dose is better.
Interesting.
Radio laryngoscopy, no difference. Direct laryngoscopy, better with the higher doses.
Indeed.
And then the overall sample, better with the higher doses.
Fascinating.
One more graph here that I think we're going to put up. Mm-hmm. It shows the overall first pass success. It's just a little line chart here with each dose. And what we're seeing is that red line is VL. It's pretty flat.
It is.
But boy, that line with DL is going straight up.
Indeed.
So bottom line, we probably ought to be using a higher dose of ROC, particularly in our hypotensive patients. My approach, I mentioned, we're using one because it's easier to calculate.
But I think two be pretty easy?
What's that?
Would two be pretty easy to calculate?
So two would be. And we actually used to use two of sucks because it was easy to calculate.
Right.
Yeah, it would. I don't know. The literature, I think, is saying one greater than 1.4. I don't know, maybe 1.5, make it a little easier. The truth is we shouldn't be doing math anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
Plug it into a computer and then it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Whip out the old Hantevi app and just use that.
That was a very nice plug.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah.
So again, I have to point out first pass is higher with VL than DL. And you know, that importance of the ROC dose, definitely higher in hypotension. And with DL.
Yeah.
Even though we don't use DL at all and we don't intubate hypotensive patients, we fix it first and then intubate them. I am still likely to increase the dose of ROC either for everybody or just the people who were initially hypotensive. Haven't made my mind up yet. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But I do think this is probably going to change my practice.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty interesting. And I know maybe some people watching or listening might be thinking, well, you know, it's observational data. They're looking at it. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, there's obviously a signal there, right? There's good information going on here. Of course, would it be better to have a randomized? Of course it would be. But I still think there's something to this because there's been a lot of talk anyway. Now we've got some literature and it's good stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, what we need, though, is maybe some information about ketamine.
Okay.
Now, what I would like, it's not a perfect segue, but we'll make it work.
Okay.
I would like, because I am also wondering, in hypotensive patients, should I adjust the dose of my induction agent? And I don't know. That's what I'm really waiting on some literature for. So I don't know. But an interesting question. We use a lot of ketamine. Now, we use ketamine in our system because we do delayed sequence intubation on all of our non-arrest intubations, and ketamine's kind of the drug for that.
Yeah.
Really hard to do it with etomidate.
Yeah.
When I intubate in the emergency department, I use ketamine, but just because I want to do the same thing my medics are doing. Etomidate is a wonderful drug. That was my go-to for a long time.
Yeah.
There is this assumption that ketamine and etomidate both are hemodynamically stable. Well, there is this big issue with etomidate because, among other things, etomidate causes adrenal suppression.
Indeed.
So it decreases the production of steroids, and those steroids are really important for sick people. So early on, there was this, and I say early on, like early on in my residency, we were all about etomidate. And then this evidence started coming out about adrenal suppression. And we started to think maybe we shouldn't be using etomidate for this. Now, ultimately, what we have learned is, yes, there is a measurable decrease in steroid production, but it's clinically insignificant with one dose. If you put them on an etomidate drip in the unit for 3 days, yeah, that's a different story.
Yeah.
But this question still sort of lingers. So paper number three is by Moore and his colleagues, again, associated all the usual suspects with the NEAR study. The name of this paper is "Etomidate Use is Associated with Less Hypotension Than Ketamine for Emergency Department Sepsis Intubations in NEAR Study." This was published in Academic Emergency Medicine 2020. All right. So that is a bit of a, I don't know, maybe clickbait with that title. I mean, basically, it's like throwing some shade here. It's saying, hey, etomidate's great. Ketamine sucks. Hypotension.
There's a lot of that goes on, I've noticed. It's kind of funny.
You know, you want people to read your tweet. You want people to engage. You want people to read your academic article.
Yeah.
Why do I call it clickbait? Well, when you the title is clearly all about etomidate versus ketamine on hypotension, right?
Yeah.
Except that's not really what the paper was about. When you read it, they say our primary purpose was just to describe the intubation characteristics of patients with sepsis versus not sepsis. But they found a sexy headline and they jumped on it. So basically, let's talk about this. What are they doing? They took all patients in the NEAR registry.
Which was a lot.
A lot. And they broke it up into those with sepsis and those without sepsis.
Yeah, there was like 13,000 almost in the NEAR registry.
Yep.
And I think they ended up with like 531 that was sepsis.
531, exactly.
Yeah.
So we know the majority of the patients we're intubating don't have sepsis.
Yeah.
But is there something special about those who do have sepsis? And it turns out, yeah, they're a little bit different. There were 3.5% of these sepsis patients that had no induction agent. And there's something that was a little frightening to me about this. Mm-hmm. When I first read the 3.2, I'm like, yeah, that just means they didn't get any medicine. They were periarrhesed. Just put the tube in. No etomidate, yeah. No ketamine, no paralytic, yeah. No nothing. I'm not sure that's what they meant. So I'm going to come back to that in a bit. Even within the sepsis patients, there were 71% who got etomidate, 27% ketamine, 0.4% midazolam. Really? Midazolam? What the hell is wrong with you? And then 1.6% propofol. So propofol, not bad.
I just had some of that, by the way, when I had my 50-year-old guy, you know, thing. And yeah, it was pretty good.
The propofol.
Yeah, yeah.
Mikey likes him some propofol.
Big fan.
Got to tell you, the only time I've had propofol was immediately before my, how did you call that?
Yeah.
That thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to leave that one.
I used a finger, could have been an arm. I don't know. I didn't care.
Because propofol,
yeah.
We got to get out of this quickly.
Yeah, that's easy. Just jump back into it.
So let's go back to this thing about no medications.
Yeah.
It turns out that they were talking about, no, they gave the paralytic, but no sedative.
That's downright.
Overall, 3% of the time.
That's way too much.
It is.
That should never happen.
Never. That is a never event. Do not give a paralytic without a sedative. If you think the patient doesn't need a paralytic to be intubated because they're so profoundly unconscious, that's a different discussion. But if you do give that paralytic, for the love of all that is holy, don't torture them. Don't run the risk of awareness during paralysis. Yeah.
Well, at least they reported it. I'm glad they did that, but holy mackerel.
Absolutely. Yeah. Interestingly, when you compare the sepsis patients to the non-sepsis patients, there were more patients without a drug in the non-sepsis group. There was more pretreatment with epinephrine in the sepsis group. So I'm assuming this is push dose epi, 1.5 versus 0.4. And if you look overall, almost 70% of patients, and this is sepsis and non-sepsis, almost 70% were intubated with etomidate versus 10 with ketamine. But when you look at that in sepsis, more patients, the proportion of patients getting ketamine for their induction went up with sepsis. So what that is telling me is that people are selecting ketamine over etomidate in septic patients, but not all septic patients, just some septic patients, which begs the question, why are you selecting ketamine instead of etomidate? Is there something different about these patients? Now, overall, if you look at peri-intubation adverse events, there were more of them in septic patients than there were in non-septic patients, regardless of the induction agent. So more peri-intubation adverse events, more peri-intubation desaturation, more peri-intubation hypotension in these septic patients than in non-septic patients. Not surprising, more septic patients had a vasopressor on board during the intubation.
That's good. And so, that wasn't like 6 liters of normal saline. Anyway, sorry, another story.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, right, drowning.
Yeah. So,
interestingly, if you go back and look at that breakdown between etomidate and ketamine, overall 10% of patients were intubated with ketamine. But if you look at the septic patients, it was 27% versus only 11% in the non-septic group. The interesting thing about that is this slide. I want to put another one up here. And this is looking at the proportion overall, the proportion of patients intubated with ketamine by hospital. So 25 participating hospitals, some use ketamine for damn near all intubations. Some almost never used ketamine. So huge, huge variability in ketamine use. And that's probably a function of local protocols or local. Yeah. Maybe there is a ketamine champion at one hospital. Maybe there is a ketamine detractor at another hospital. So those are the overall characteristics. We know that those patients with getting intubated for sepsis compared to everybody else, they are definitely different. They are more likely to have a peri-intubation badness, and they're more likely to be on pressors. So now let's take a look at the head-to-head etomidate versus ketamine for septic patient intubation. Overall, 27% of patients got ketamine, 71% got etomidate. And the take-home argument on this is that there was no difference in first-pass success, no difference in desaturation, no difference in other serious adverse events, except what's in the title, hypotension. Peri-intubation hypoxia occurred 74% of patients who were inducted with ketamine versus 50% who were inducted with etomidate. That is an odds ratio, unadjusted, of 2.9, and that is statistically significant. But maybe it was the dose. Well, let's take a look. The median dose, and I'm assuming this was IV, median dose of ketamine was 100 milligrams. And if you're assuming a 70 kilo patient, then that's around, I don't know, math, maybe 1.5, let's call it, per kilo. Reasonable. I mean, the usual dose is between 1 and 2 milligrams per kilogram. I typically go with 2. Mm-hmm. Atomidate, the recommended dose is 0.3 milligrams per kilogram. For a 70 kilo patient, that would be 21 milligrams. The median dose, 20 milligrams. So right on the dosing there. So those are reasonable doses for both ketamine and atomidate. That is probably not the cause for the hypotension. Now, the other part about this is, well, yeah, but did you do something for that hypotension? So did you use pressors for that hypotension? And it turns out there was no difference between atomidate and ketamine in whether you actually treated the hypotension. So that suggests to me that if there really is hypotension, it is very transient. Hmm. It is not long enough that we're going to actually do something about it.
Yeah. And I wonder how many people were on pressors already because of their situation, right?
Yeah. And that really brings up the, I think, the fundamental problem with this study, with what we just looked at, which is indication bias.
Yeah.
Why did some patients get ketamine and others get atomidate? Is it because people were preferentially intubating the hypotensive patients with ketamine? Therefore, it shouldn't be surprising that they're hypotensive. So indication bias, it's a big deal. Now, the authors are these are wise people. They're smart folks. They understand the concept of indication bias. So they tried to correct for it. And they did this sensitivity analysis using a propensity matched approach. Now, propensity matching can get kind of complicated. We are going, here's another foreshadowing, another omen, if you will. I am going to be taking a trip to a certain foreign country coming up where they might serve tequilas and tacos.
Oh, copy.
And one of my friends is going to be going with me. We're going to have a big group, and one of my friends just happens to really like tequila and tacos and know an awful lot about statistics. So I'm going to do a pod with the famous Dr. Rimley Crowe, winner of this year's Paul Pepe Award at the Eagles, by the way.
Indeed.
And we're going to talk propensity matching. But for now, let's just say that this is a way of trying to control for that indication bias. And when they did it, they did all of their things. They saw that there was no adverse events that, or no difference in adverse events between ketamine and atomidate. There was no difference in the rates of hypoxia. But again, there was a difference, even controlling for indication bias, between those who got ketamine and those who got atomidate. And they came up with an adjusted odds ratio for hypotension of 2.7. So 170% increase in the odds. And again, if you look at, well, what about hypotension that needed treatment? No difference. Mm. So bottom line here, sepsis is bad. Probably ought to try to avoid it. Peri-intubation hypotension and hypoxia are both more common in sepsis than not sepsis. There is a massive variation in the use of ketamine for intubation in emergency departments. Even though I have no idea what to do with this propensity matching, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that there is a signal here that maybe ketamine is, at least in sepsis patients, associated with more hypotension than atomidate is. Still thinking there's some indication bias here. I want to sit down with Rimley and talk about this propensity matching thing. But for now, we should at least put it on our radar that maybe ketamine is not the panacea that we might have thought it was.
Yeah. And I think, like, if I had a dollar for every time I've heard that statement over the last 2 years about ketamine, I mean, it's great. And there are definitely sweet spots for those. I think people are still trying to figure those out. But it is, yeah, it's just not what everyone thinks it is, right? I mean, well, it's just another tool that we need to be smart with, and studies like this, right? Yes, it's not the big, great randomized controlled trial. But like you said, again, there's a little signal there. Maybe we should pay attention to some of this stuff. And,
absolutely. Yeah. Now, I do have to point out there actually have been randomized controlled trials of atomidate versus ketamine, and they did not show any difference.
Huh.
Yeah. So take that for what it's worth.
Yeah.
I think your point, though, is really, really good, Mikey. And that is also the same point that came out of episode 45, where we were discussing ketamine with the famous Dr. Brimley. That's, you know, Brent and Brimley. And that was their takeaway also, is ketamine is a wonderful drug, but it's not benign. Treat it with respect, just like we should treat every drug in our arsenal with respect.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed.
Well, man, those are the three papers. I think we want to try to maybe atone for our hour and a half long podcast on ketamine.
Give them a little break.
I think we can give them a little break. Get out of here under an hour. What do you think?
Why don't we just get on out of here? So on behalf of Dr. Jeff Jarvis, as always, thank you, sir, for all the great information. Mike Verkest, you've been watching to and listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the Flybridge Ed podcast family and
a Fire Dog production.
We will see you guys on the next one. Take care.
Bye, guys.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the Flybridge Ed podcast family and a Fire Dog production. Visit flightbridgeed.com for more information.